All right, Natalie, we can go ahead and get started.
Great. Good afternoon. My name is Natalie, and I'll be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the American Disability Act and website. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, we will have a question and answer session. You can ask a question by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. It is now my pleasure to turn today's program over to Peter Berg with Great Lakes ADA. The floor is yours.
All right. Thank you very much, Natalie, and welcome everyone to the March session of the ADA Audio Conference Series. Here in Chicago, we're looking at a balmy 50 degrees or so. So I hope wherever you are, you're enjoying some bright, sunny weather and the wind is at your back. The ADA Audio Conference is a program of the ADA National Network. The ADA National Network is funded by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Administration on Community Living, National Institute on Disability, Independent Living, and Rehabilitation Research. You can locate the regional ADA center that serves your state by visiting adata.org. The ADA centers provide guidance and training on the Americans with Disabilities Act. As Natalie mentioned, for those of you on the telephone, when we get to the portion of the session today, when there will be questions, we'll bring Natalie back to give those instructions again. For those of you participating through the webinar platform, as you heard earlier, you can submit your questions in the chat area throughout the session. So don't hold on to your questions. Get those questions in early. So we are pleased to have with us Jared Smith, the Associate Director with WebAIM, talking about a very important topic, a very hot topic as it goes, and the application of the Americans with Disabilities Act to websites used by state, local governments, and places of public accommodation or businesses, for-profit, non-profit, and what it means to have accessible websites, accessible technology. So we are pleased at this point. I am pleased to introduce our speaker, Jared, and welcome, and I would like to turn the session over to you at this time.
Okay. Thank you, Peter, for the introduction. I appreciate the opportunity to be here and to talk about the ADA and websites. I'm Jared Smith from WebAIM. WebAIM stands for Web Accessibility in Mind. We are a nonprofit web accessibility consultancy based at the Center for Persons with Disabilities at Utah State University. And we do web accessibility. That's what we're passionate about. We help to educate and empower organizations to build and maintain their own accessibility over time. I'd invite you to check out our website, webaim.org. There's a wealth of articles and tutorials and materials, resources, research. We have an online community around the topic of web accessibility. So today I am going to talk about the ADA and websites and what is required with those, and I'm going to kind of build into this a little bit. I think probably for this audience, as I go to the next slide, number 9, I probably don't need to say too much about those with disabilities. We know about 20% of the population has a disability, over a billion people on this planet. As we analyze the types of disabilities that are reported, and most of this comes from census data, we know that about 8.5% of the population has a disability that can impact computer use. Now, this is a very minimal number. It does not include those with cognitive or learning disabilities, which arguably is larger than 8.5% all by itself. It doesn't include those with color blindness, which would be around 3.5% to 4% of the population, and a few others. So, you know, we can look at that 8.5% and kind of consider for ourselves, what that might mean for us, what the impact is, whether that's a big number, whether it's a small number. It's a little hard to say. The biggest thing I want to stress is that we are talking about people. Yeah, regardless of numbers, regardless of technical requirements, regardless of what the law says, I think that's most important to consider, that we're talking about people and people that can be significantly impacted for good or for bad based on your decisions when it comes to web accessibility. For many with disabilities, the web is a primary mechanism for them to engage in commerce, in education, in banking, and all of these other things that we enjoy and maybe take a little bit for granted online. The web is really just a godsend and such an amazing resource for people with disabilities to independently engage using their own technologies, taking the time that they need in the ways that they need, and entirely online, so long as what is provided to them is built with accessibility in mind. One interesting way to think about this 8.5% isn't just that we can extend our reach to this population by implementing accessibility, but that we can really maybe see it as a market opportunity and maybe as an ethical opportunity to really have a notable impact on their lives. So go to the next slide. There's a photo here of the iPhone. So when the iPhone was first released, it had very good accessibility built into it, very accessible to many users with disabilities, including users that were blind. It wasn't perfect and still isn't perfect, but is very accessible. So if you were blind and you wanted a really cool phone, were you going to purchase an iPhone or a phone that was inaccessible to you because you know it hadn't been designed with accessibility in mind? And of course you were going to purchase an iPhone. And we saw in a very short period of time a significant shift in the disability community to iPhones. And then iPhones and iPads, and then iPhones and iPads and MacBook Pros. And you know, Android and others have come along and now support good accessibility. But Apple was there first. And surveys that we have conducted at WebAIM of users with disabilities show that adoption of iOS Apple devices is significantly higher among the disability community than other populations. Enough so that it's pretty safe to say that, you know, users with disabilities represent a notable part of Apple's market share. So maybe Apple was seeing dollar signs in their decision to implement accessibility into these devices, but the reality is that it's had a notable impact. I've heard from blind friends and colleagues that have said that the iPhone is the most significant, impactful thing that has improved their lives ever, period. And that's pretty amazing, I think. I love my iPhone, but I don't think that it's been that impactful on my life. And I think that's an interesting way to view accessibility, is not just extending your reach, but that people with disabilities can come to you to get the services, information, resources, products that you provide. Now, my focus will be on individuals with disabilities, but as I go to slide 11, there are additional benefits to implementing accessibility. As we consider making websites that are more compatible with the assistive technologies that people with disabilities might use, then you're making it more compatible with machines. And Google is a big machine, and we see a lot of additional benefits to search engine rankings by implementing good machine-compatible accessibility. You might consider for a moment this next question, and I use that term assistive technology, and that's some sort of technology that due to a physical issue or limitation, if you didn't have that technology, you'd have difficulty functioning the way that you do every day. And it's interesting that assistive technology is actually quite common. I suspect that there are many of you that maybe really do use traditional assistive technology, but probably very many of you that wear glasses or contact lenses. And those of you that wear glasses or contacts, I suspect that many or maybe most of you would have difficulty functioning the way that you do every day if you didn't have that assistive technology of glasses or contacts. You know, is this an assistive technology? Or maybe another way to ask that question is, do you have a disability? You know, if it sounds like you couldn't function the way that you normally would without that assistive technology, then perhaps you do. But most people that wear glasses or contacts don't really consider themselves to have a disability, and that is primarily because their environment works with that assistive technology. Imagine if you encountered a website that didn't work with glasses or contacts. Suddenly that would make that disability, and really something that maybe you haven't considered a disability, would suddenly make that very relevant. In some ways, there really was no disability until the barrier was introduced. The incompatibility was introduced to that assistive technology. In some ways, that site disabled you in a way that there would have been no barrier otherwise. So it's an interesting way to think about accessibility, is compatibility with these technologies. Now, there's much more to accessibility than just making things work with technology. We want it to work for everyone, and there are many additional benefits to accessibility beyond assistive technology and even beyond those with disabilities, but that will be our primary focus. As we think about accessibility, I think it's helpful to consider accessibility as being a continuum, something that we can continually improve upon, that we can do better at, because we're talking about the human experience, because humans are so dynamic, it's hard to define accessibility as this, like an on-off state, right? Like suddenly we hit some threshold and ta-da, now we're accessible. And that's not really how it works, because of that really dynamic human nature of accessibility and of disability. So it's useful to view accessibility as this continuum, something we can always improve upon. I was just 15, 20 minutes ago making improvements to accessibility on the webaim.org site. This is a site that's been significantly designed and built for accessibility, and we strive really hard to make sure that it works really well. But there were a few things that I noticed I just wanted to refine and improve to increase where we're at, to move along that continuum just a little bit more. Now, it is helpful to have measures along the continuum of accessibility. On slide 14, we have a brief overview of the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines, WCAG, or I may say WCAG. If I say WCAG, I'm referring to the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines. These are an international set of guidelines defined by the World Wide Web Consortium, the W3C, which is the standards body for the web. They define HTML and CSS and these other technology standards that we use to build the web. They have a set of accessibility guidelines. These guidelines are designed to be very principles-based. The four foundational principles of these guidelines are perceivable, operable, understandable, and robust, our POUR principles, P-O-U-R principles. And these are really nice principles to think about just when we consider accessibility generally. We want things to work for users. We want our content to be perceivable, to get it to their senses in a way they can start to do something meaningful with it. Once the user can perceive content, they want to be able to operate or navigate within that. It needs to be understandable and make sense to them. And it needs to be robust. It needs to actually work with the technologies and assistive technologies that they are using. So those principles form the foundation of these guidelines. Below those principles, we have what are called guidelines. They're very high-level statements about accessibility, things like provide alternative text for non-text elements, make things keyboard accessible, don't cause seizures, right? Very high-level principles. And then below those are success criteria. That's where the rubber meets the road. That's where we measure conformance or compliance with the guidelines themselves. Every success criterion is assigned a level, A, AA, or AAA. The A criteria, those are the foundational aspects of accessibility. If you don't meet the single A things in WCAG, you're going to almost certainly introduce significant barriers to users with disabilities. Some may not be able to access your content at all. The AA success criteria, those are kind of add and extend the single A things. If AA would be things, if you didn't implement those, that users may have more difficulty or frustration or take more time accessing your content. And then AAA, those are more enhancements to accessibility that may provide some benefit for some users with disabilities, but generally are much more difficult or burdensome to implement and may not even be relevant for all websites or web content. So the way the structure works is, say if your goal was to be WCAG to AA compliant, that means you would also need to meet the single A requirements. To be AAA, you would need to meet all of the A, AA, and AAA success criteria. AAA really isn't a goal, shouldn't be a goal or objective for most sites, but there are a lot of good things in there that you can reference to enhance accessibility. So that's an overall view of the structure of these guidelines. The first version of the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines was finalized in 1999. This is not new. We've had guidelines for a very long time. They were updated in 2008 to version 2.0, and then June of last year, that version was updated to version 2.1. With 2.1, what happened is some new success criteria were added. 2.1 does not change anything in 2.0 itself. It just adds some new success criteria, primarily in the area of mobile accessibility, mobile web content and mobile applications, because in 2008, this was really just kind of new. The W3C is also currently working on updates to these, so with an anticipation that we will see more frequent updates to these guidelines in the future. So these are just great resources. These guidelines, they're not perfect. They don't cover every aspect of accessibility, but they are good guidelines. They're a good measurement for accessibility, and certainly what we would recommend as being a primary reference when it comes to accessibility. Okay, moving to slide 15, we have a checklist on the WebAIM site. Because the guidelines are very principles-based and they kind of use this confusing and ethereal technology-agnostic language, they can sometimes be rather difficult to understand. We have created a checklist on the WebAIM site that kind of boils down that weird, fuzzy, technical language, academic language, and makes it much more approachable. So this can be a useful resource, and it's available at webaim.org. It's, I think, 6 or 7 pages, covers all of the aspects of these guidelines in a language that's more accessible, more usable and understandable to most everyone. Okay, next slide. It is important to consider, however, that your site can be compliant yet still be inaccessible. Again, if we view accessibility as a continuum, these compliance with a set of guidelines just means that you have met one particular threshold or measure along that continuum. That means there will always be users with disabilities that may still find your content difficult or inaccessible. So we need to think about users beyond just compliance. And to take this a step further, on the next slide, your site can be technically accessible yet functionally inaccessible. What that means is that you can implement the technical aspects of accessibility, yet still have an experience that functionally is not very friendly to people with disabilities. The example I like to use of this is if you consider someone that may have difficulty using a mouse or a touchpad or touchscreen. Very often, somebody with a motor disability may interact with a web page using the keyboard. You can hit the Tab key on your keyboard to navigate through interactive elements. Think for just a moment about your website or maybe a site that you're very familiar with. How many times would you need to hit the Tab key on your keyboard from the very beginning of that page to the main content area? Maybe you'd have to navigate maybe through the logo or site name, maybe a search field, maybe navigation, maybe the navigation has drop-down or fly-out menus, maybe a sidebar, breadcrumbs, other types of things before you get to the main content area. It may be that you need to hit the Tab key a few times. It might be a lot. It might be a whole lot. We've seen as many as 600 navigation items on a web page that have to be navigated through before you could get to the main content, and on every single page of that website. So that is actually technically accessible. It is even compliant with the guidelines. The guidelines simply say that the website needs to be keyboard accessible, and it is. But is that functionally accessible? You know, consider somebody that has significant motor disabilities. you know, a former colleague of ours used a stick in his mouth to interact with the keyboard. Imagine with a stick in your mouth having to hit that tab key 600 times. Technically accessible, yes. Compliant, yes. Functionally accessible, probably not. Users probably aren't going to engage with that. So we want to use the guidelines as guidelines. We want to favor accessibility over compliance. We want the guidelines to guide, to help inform a good end user experience with the understanding that the guidelines do not ensure accessibility. We want to focus on the user primarily. Okay, slide 19. Now we're going to get into the legal aspects a little bit more. I first want to start with Section 508. This is something that's very often referred to in accessibility and compliance. Section 508 is part of the Rehabilitation Act. It applies to federal government. That is the scope of Section 508. It applies to development and building, purchasing, electronic and information technology within the federal government. So while the scope of the law, Section 508 is federal government, it defines technical standards that very often have a much broader scope because the federal government is big. As an example, a federal agency may provide federal funding and may require compliance with the Section 508 guidelines as a requirement of receiving those federal funds. So that wouldn't mean that Section 508, the law, directly applies to those recipients of the funding, but the technical requirements in Section 508 do, because the federal agency has dictated that, because the law does apply to them. Many states have also adopted Section 508 guidelines as state law, sometimes with some modifications. So a lot of states also include these standards with various levels of scoping, sometimes only to state agencies, sometimes to state agencies and, say, public education institutions. Some extend broader than that. Section 508 was updated January of last year to incorporate the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines 2.0, Level A and Level AA. So those guidelines are now the technical requirements for Section 508 for web content. So that's another motivation for looking at those guidelines. Of note is this is version 2.0, not version 2.1. We don't anticipate an update to Section 508 to WCAG 2.1 in the near future. It took us about 12 years to update it to WCAG 2.0. We're glad that that finally occurred last year. But for now, it is 2.0 A and AA success criteria. Another quick term I want to cover, and that is VPAT, V-P-A-T, or Voluntary Product Accessibility Template. This is a standardized template defined by industry to allow a standardized mechanism for documenting compliance with Section 508. So a lot of, say corporations want to do business with the federal government. This provided them one standardized template whereby they could document how they meet or don't meet the requirements of Section 508. We are, however, seeing the VPAT in a lot of other areas. States, state education institutions, even some other businesses are now starting to ask for or require a VPAT as part of a procurement process. So it's a mechanism where you could have a vendor define, document their compliance with the technical requirements of Section 508, which is now WCAG 2.0 A and AA. So it's important, I think, to be familiar with that term. If you're either maybe selling or providing products, you may be asked for a VPAT. If you're in a position to procure products, that can be a way for you to get documentation about compliance with the understanding that trust but verify when it comes to this documentation. Okay, moving on to slide 20. Now we're going to get into the Americans with Disabilities Act. The ADA predates the web. The word web, the word internet, does not appear anywhere within the Americans with Disabilities Act. So that's just one of the most important things we'll talk about is how does this, or does this at all, apply to the web. Within the ADA itself, there is no direct mention of the web or internet. There are three primary areas or titles of the ADA. Title one is employment. This is really important to that we don't overlook employment. Very often entities, as they consider web accessibility, they start with their public pages, their home pages, their most visited public pages, things like that. Maybe for education, they start with student resources, and those are all important. Those are going to have a big impact on users, but don't overlook employment. As an example, if you were to develop a disability, and statistically most of us will in our lifetime, and you couldn't do your job because of the inaccessibility of systems that you're required to use, does that sound like discrimination? I'm not a lawyer, but it does to me, and the ADA clearly covers employment. So don't overlook those internal systems, HR systems, intranets, employee applications, things like that. Title II is state and local governments, also including public education entities, very clearly covered by the ADA. Title III is places, it's public and commercial facilities. The term very often used is places of public accommodation. This has been a primary question for some time. Is the web a place of public accommodation? In other words, can an inaccessible website be considered discriminatory under the Americans with Disabilities Act? The answer most of the time to that question has been yes. The web is covered by the ADA. The Department of Justice, the enforcement entity for the ADA, has clarified that, yes, they believe that the web is covered by the ADA, that it can be considered discriminatory, but what they have not yet done is define any technical standard as to what that means. So, in short, to answer the question of what is required under the ADA, the title of this webinar, it's to not discriminate based on disabilities. That's what the ADA talks about. It talks about civil rights for people with disabilities and discrimination, but it does not yet define technical standards. So slide 22 just clarifies that. We don't have those technical standards yet for web content. Oh, we do have those for other aspects of the ADA. For instance, a wheelchair ramp, there are technical requirements that the ramp can only be so steep. That's easy to measure. We have those technical standards for, how wide a door needs to be, the height of drinking fountains, things like that. We do not yet have any of that guidance when it comes to web or digital content. So I sometimes equate this to being pulled over and given a speeding ticket on a street that has no speed limit signs. And that's kind of the situation that we're in, that you could get pulled over and say, what did I do wrong? Well, you were going too fast. Well, what is too fast? And it can really be whatever that officer determines it to be, because we don't have the mileposts. We don't have the speed limit signs for web accessibility. Now, with that said, we do kind of have some de facto standards. The lawsuits that we have seen, complaints to the Department of Justice, to the Office of Civil Rights within the Department of Education, Department of Justice settlements, have all generally required WCAG 2.0 A and AA as the technical standard, as the measure of discrimination. So that's where it's at. Again, are those guidelines, but this has not yet been defined. There was a process that was underway to define these technical standards within the ADA. That process has been halted by the current administration. We don't anticipate that there will be progress in at least the near future in updating these technical standards. So it leaves us in a little bit of a nebulous position where there are a lot of lawsuits. Many lawsuits. The number of lawsuits last year more than doubled the number of lawsuits in 2017. So we're seeing significant increase in legal action. Some of that I think may be driven by the fact that we're not seeing technical updates, and that the processes to within the Office of Civil Rights for People with Disabilities to maybe get action or reprieve where they feel they have been discriminated against, where some of that has been pulled back or halted. They're lawyering up. They feel that is a mechanism for them to get some justice. And it's hard to fault them for that. With that said, we are seeing a lot of activity, legal activity around the ADA in absence of clear technical guidelines. Along with those technical guidelines, we also need implementation standards. And when the ADA first passed, it did not require every building to immediately be accessible. There were timelines. You know, maybe by this particular date it needed to be accessible, or next time you renovate the building. If you were a small business, or say running a business out of your home, you didn't have to put in a wheelchair ramp. But if suddenly you reached a certain number of employees, now there were technical requirements for physical accessibility. And that was really helpful to implement those requirements over time and provide something that was reasonable but also supported accessibility over time. Again, we don't have any of those technical or implementation standards yet defined for the web. So it's a bit of a wild, wild web where we are seeing a lot of this driven by legal action, which I'm sure is probably a driving factor for many of you to be listening today. Most of the places where we see this legal action are in areas where there is clear inaccessibility. There is clear noncompliance with web content accessibility guidelines. It would be hard to justify that there is not discrimination occurring if people with disabilities are having significant difficulty with a website. You know, if you're doing 90 in a school zone, you know, the officer has a pretty good case against you, even if there's no speed limit signs. And I think that's the reality in most cases, but we are seeing some cases that are maybe more trivial, maybe where there's difficulty for them to document or justify that discrimination has occurred. So, you know, on our next slide, that kind of brings up the question of ADA compliant and what that actually means when it comes to web content. I hear that all the time. People tell me, say, I need to make my website ADA compliant. And it doesn't really mean a lot. I guess it means, you know, non-discriminatory, but in the absence of those technical guidelines, it's hard to know exactly what that means. Our approach, all of our goal should be to make things work, to make them accessible, to make them reasonably accessible to those with disabilities. And I think if we do that, then we're in a good place despite the ambiguity of the law currently. Okay, slide 24, just a couple other things regarding some legal requirements and WCAG 2.1. We have seen the first settlements of lawsuits under the ADA that have now referenced version 2.1 of those guidelines, because they're now the standard, international standard for web content. We are starting to see ADA processes that are requiring and referencing 2.1. Again, there's nothing in the law to keep them from referencing any guideline whatsoever, so we are starting to see those, and I think that's great because 2.1 does help support much better accessibility. In the state of California, there is a state statute that will require 2.1 compliance for state agencies and other state entities as of July of this year in the EU. There's also a standard that would require 2.1 conformance for new websites by September of this year and all websites September 2020. So those are just a few things in regards to this newest version of the accessibility guidelines. Okay, slide 25. Just a few thoughts about minimizing risk, some things that you can do to, you know, if you're concerned about legal action, you're concerned about complaints and processes under the ADA. The first one, make your stuff accessible. You know, if your users are having a great experience, they're not encountering barriers, that's going to be very difficult for those processes to have any grounds. So make things work. That's the biggest thing. You want your content to be accessible to your users. Also very important is to have a policy and an implementation plan in place. have a well-defined policy that outlines your goals, your objectives for accessibility, and a plan to get there. You may not be perfect right now, and that's okay, but having a plan in place to help you get to better accessibility and compliance is just really critical, not only to your own success, but it can help minimize the impact if there were to be a complaint or lawsuit. If a lawyer knocks on your door or the Office of Civil Rights receives a complaint, if you have a policy and an implementation plan that is reasonable, very often they'll say, okay, looks like you have a plan, please carry on. If you don't, these will be defined for you. You will have technical requirements and timelines defined for you, and very often those are going to be much more difficult and very shorter timelines than maybe you would have defined for yourselves. Also, address automatically detectable errors. Use evaluation tools such as WAVE, which is a tool developed by us here at WebAIM, to check your site for things that a computer can detect. Now, detectable errors only represent a small portion of the total compliance things that are out there. Tools are quite limited in what they can tell you, but there are many out there, including those that are filing lawsuits, that are simply using automated tools to look for errors. They then equate detectable errors with discrimination and use that as justification for complaints and lawsuits. So addressing those automatically detectable errors can provide a bit of a barrier there, a way to minimize some of that initial risk. And it's going to make your content more accessible. So if a tool can tell you that something is not compliant, if there's an accessibility issue, it's generally representative of a notable end user issue, something that impacts users. So fix it. It'll make your site more accessible. Okay, slide 26. I'm going to cover these pretty quickly. I'm going to get into just some more of the technical aspects of accessibility. I may even skip a few slides here just for sake of time. I want to make sure that we leave plenty of time for questions. But I want to cover some of the how-to. How do we start to implement accessibility? What are the considerations? How do people with disabilities access and use the web? I want to start talking about auditory disabilities. The general approach here is to provide captions and transcripts. So provide captions for video and live audio, and provide text transcripts for all audio content. So the captions are the text that appear on screen as it is spoken. The text transcript is a written version of the spoken information. It would also include any other important content from that media, maybe things that are visual only, such as who is speaking, identifying the speaker. Maybe if there are is text that appears on screen that is not verbalized, it would be important that that text be captured or other visual content be captured in a transcript. Maybe also any audio-only information, such as explosion or laughter or background music, if that's relevant or important to the content, you would want to put that in this descriptive text transcript. The idea is that the user can get all of the content of the multimedia by reading that transcript without having to engage with the multimedia itself, especially if they can't see or hear or both see or hear that multimedia content. So very kind of straightforward, at least in regards to what is required and what helps support accessibility, not so easy to actually do. Slide 28, we outline some transcription methods. This is by far the most difficult and expensive aspect of media accessibility, is generating text from the spoken word. Three primary methods for this. You can type it out. That can be very accurate. Can be inexpensive, just to pay somebody to type out what's spoken, but it's really slow. Few people can type at the speed that people speak. So you know it's going to take a long time to generate the transcript using that method. The second approach is stenography, using a stenograph machine like a court reporting machine that allows the user of that machine to type phonetically and very quickly at the same rate that people speak. This can produce very high quality captions and transcripts, and can do that very quickly, but it comes at a cost. You have to hire somebody with that technical expertise, typically outsourcing. There's also a newer approach for transcription that uses something called a shadow speaker. A shadow speaker uses voice recognition technology and repeats into their well-trained voice recognition software on their computer everything that they hear in the multimedia or even in live events, you know, webinars, broadcasts, conferences. They can listen and repeat back into that software to generate that highly accurate text basically in real time. That's another approach. Again, very quick, high-quality captions for the most part, but expensive because you have to pay somebody with that expertise. The third approach is automated captioning. So this would use automated voice recognition technology like YouTube. You can upload a video, it will analyze the audio and generate text from that. The primary issue with automated captioning is always quality. On the next slide, you can see there are some captions on this video screen, and the captions read, "Is officially tomatoes its prison's rations? He looked for it." it's just gibberish. It doesn't make any sense. And these are automatically generated captions from analyzing the audio. So these can be wonderful. The quality can be rather high with very clear audio, no background noise or music, well enunciated English. The captions can be pretty good. Anything other than that, the quality degrades quite quickly. So this can be very quick, almost real time. It's free. These technologies are free, at least as far as the technology itself, but the quality is the issue. So, you know, in design and development, we talk a lot about the rule of two-thirds, where you can have cheap, quality, or fast, and you can only pick two. All three of those techniques for transcription, you know, fall into one of those three categories. You can never get all three. Automated captioning, you know, via something like YouTube can be a good start. If you then go back and manually curate those captions, fix the mistakes, and improve that quality. So those are the techniques for users with auditory disabilities. There are a lot of additional benefits, however, to captions and transcripts that extend beyond just accessibility. I'm sure that probably everybody here has benefited from captions or transcripts at some point in time. For instance, real noisy environments, an airport or a sports bar, seeing the captions makes that accessible. Or a very quiet environment, you're in the library and you want to engage with a video, having captions on screen allow that to be accessible without hearing the audio. These make the content of media searchable, not only to search engines, but also to end users. They can be translated into other languages. If the language of the media and the language of the listener are not the same primary language, having those captions can benefit understanding and learning. For users with cognitive and learning disabilities, to see that text on screen or in a transcript can be very beneficial. In fact, studies have shown that it's beneficial to everyone. Having those captions on screen help everyone with understanding, retention, and remembering the content from multimedia. For users with low vision, this is a very significant audience. Low vision generally being defined as vision that cannot be adequately corrected with glasses or contacts. You know, there are a lot of different types of low vision. It might, you know, generally we think of, you know, users that just need larger content where it's a visual acuity thing. But there are a lot of other types of visual disabilities, such as light or contrast perception, where you need significant contrast to be able to see things. Some users are negatively impacted by too much contrast. There's color perception, where colors may not be discernible, where certain color combinations can be difficult to see. Obstructed primary visual field of view, or tunnel vision, where maybe you can only see a small portion of the screen. Tremors in your eyes, things like that. Primarily, we think about enlarging content. This is a slide from a screenshot from Amazon at 100%. On slide 33, if we enlarge that to 200%, it's quite a bit larger. We have found from surveys we've conducted that about a third of respondents with low vision don't enlarge web content at all, or at least very much. Maybe if you have tunnel vision, for instance, making the content larger makes it worse, right? Because you can see less of it at one point in time. with a small visual field of view. It may actually be advantageous to decrease the size of some content. About a third of respondents indicate they enlarge content to about this size, to about 200%, which is quite large when you see it. And then slide 34, about a third of respondents enlarge content much, much larger, to up to 400% or even larger than this. This is 400% on screen. So some interesting considerations as content is enlarged by the end user. One is the use of text within images. As text is enlarged, it becomes more pixelated and blocky, a little more difficult to read and perceive that text, as opposed to true text or real text within a page. This is something that the accessibility guidelines cover. They say if you can get the same visual presentation by using real text as opposed to text within an image, then do that. Use real text. Then there are a lot of additional benefits to using that real text as opposed to text within an image. Now, it doesn't always make sense. You know, something like a logo, yeah, you may need to put text in within a graphical logo, but you would want to help ensure and test that as that image is enlarged, that it maintains its readability and crispness of that text. Slide 36 provides sufficient contrast. This is something that's important for users with various visual disabilities, but it's important for everyone. We all struggle and have difficulty with content that has insufficient contrast. This is, interestingly, I think it's pretty safe to say that this is the most pervasive accessibility issue on the web. At least it's the most common detectable failure with web content accessibility guidelines is providing insufficient contrast. At WebAIM, just about 2 weeks ago, we released the results of an analysis of the home pages for the top 1 million websites. So we, using automated tools, analyzed 1 million home pages, and we found a lot of interesting information, mostly that there's a lot of accessibility issues on the web, and low contrast was by far the most prevalent issue that we identified. It was present on 85% of pages had text that had insufficient contrast. So how do we know, you know, what are some considerations here? One is just to understand that the user has ultimate control over the way your content appears. They can override your text colors. They can turn on high contrast. If there are certain color combinations that they need to best perceive and view your content, they can override your colors. So your design is not the design that everybody will see. You want to design your pages to be adaptable and flexible. If the user adapts their content or changes it, you want to be flexible and ensure that your content maintains its accessibility as the user customizes it to their needs. Slide 38, if you want to know where you're at when it comes to compliance for text contrast, you just need to implement this very basic formula that's defined in the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines. No, you're probably not going to be doing this complex math, but it is important to know that there are measures for contrast. The Web Content Accessibility Guidelines has this formula, which based on a foreground color and a background color will generate a contrast ratio. They then define thresholds based on that ratio for pass or fail states. And there are some other considerations in there. But just know that there are metrics for this. You don't want to be doing this type of math, but there are functions for measuring sufficient contrast. Okay, slide 39. This just illustrates that using that formula, if you had white text on a black background or black text on a white background, the contrast ratio is 21:1. That's the highest possible contrast ratio. This does not necessarily mean that this is best. I mentioned before, some users can be impacted by high contrast, too much contrast, especially with very modern displays that are very bright. They have dark darks and very white whites. Having too much contrast can impact readability. It can also cause some users with dyslexia to have additional difficulty. Dyslexia is not a visual disability. It's a cognitive processing functioning thing where letters and words can get jumbled and mixed around. With too much contrast, it can cause like halos or floaters around the text, which can aggravate that condition and cause the impacts of dyslexia to be enhanced. So you might want to consider that. Maybe a slight off-white or a very dark gray foreground color could maybe be a little bit better. The guidelines do not define a maximum contrast threshold. They don't consider that at all. Slide 40, this outlines what is required at level AA within those guidelines. It requires a contrast ratio of 4.5:1 for text. So there are some examples on screen of gray and purple text on white, red on yellow. Those are all examples of text that is exactly at that 4.5:1. Ratio, which is the minimum required at AA. They have a lower threshold for large text at 3:1. Large text is defined as 18 point, which is about 24 pixels or larger, or 14 point, which is about 18.6 pixels or larger. The idea is if it's big or big and bold, it doesn't have to have as much contrast because it's big and bold. So you can use tools. Slide 41 outlines a tool that we have developed at WebAIM where you can put in a foreground color, a background color, and it will do all of that math for you. It will indicate where those color combinations align with the accessibility guidelines. So use these types of tools to make it a lot easier to know where you're at. Slide 42, just a couple notes about WCAG 2.1. This, again, 2.1 adds some new things to 2.0. It doesn't change 2.0, but adds some new requirements. One of those new requirements in 2.1 is sufficient contrast for non-text elements. 2.0 only applies to text and text within images. So this requires a 3:1 contrast ratio for user interface components, so things that the user might interact with and see that convey meaning. That would also include like keyboard focus indicators. As you're hitting the tab key, the browser will draw an outline or border around the thing that you have focused on. You want to be able to see that with sufficient contrast. Also requires sufficient contrast of elements as they're being interacted with. Say if you hover your mouse over an element, it still needs to have sufficient contrast in that hover state. And also 3:1 contrast for graphical objects, icons, images, things that convey information or meaning. So a user interface component would be like the border of a text box. You want to see where that text box is at. It would also cover the check within that checkbox. Important for you to know whether that checkbox is checked or not. Graphical objects would include things like the Facebook, the Twitter icon, things like that we are much more common in modern web design than they were in the past. This is a really nice gap that has been patched by WCAG 2.1 to support better accessibility of these non-text elements. It is at a very minimal contrast ratio. 3:1 is pretty low contrast. It's kind of the minimal required for many users to see, but it does define that minimal threshold. You would probably want to go beyond that, have better contrast for better readability and usability, because again, this is not just a disability thing. It's something that impacts everyone. Okay, slide 43, just a few words about color reliance. I mentioned color blindness or color deficiency, as it's a little more technically called, which is a difficulty in differentiating between certain color combinations. There are many different forms of color blindness. The most common is a red-green color deficiency. It doesn't mean a user can't see red or can't see green. It just means that certain shades of red and green can be difficult to differentiate when they're used together. So in this case, we have a list of mushrooms. The green mushrooms listed here are okay to eat. The red mushrooms will kill you. Visually, they all appear the same. You're seeing this list as it would be seen by somebody with the most common form of red-green color deficiency or color blindness. So I'm not sure if you know your mushrooms very well, but you might pick for yourself which of these you might take a chance at eating, assuming you like mushrooms at all. And then slide 44 shows the actual results. Amanita and Tylopolis are in red. The middle three are in green. So this is a case of color reliance. Now, this does not suggest that you shouldn't use color, that you can't use color. You can. You can use color. It's great for accessibility. It's great for usability. You just want to ensure that you're not relying on color to convey information or meaning. So there are a few things that could be done here to adapt this content for better accessibility. You know, you could use icons to visually differentiate those, other types of styling. You would also want to consider somebody that is blind is also colorblind. If someone can't see the screen, the color information is also lost. And again, users can override your page colors, and that color information may be lost. So there are a lot of people that can be impacted by color reliance. Okay, slide 45 talks about screen reader users. Screen reader is assistive technology used by somebody primarily with visual disabilities to have text content on a page presented audibly to them. It is important to note that not all screen reader users are completely blind. Many of them have low vision and use the screen reader to supplement with audio what they may have difficulty seeing visually on the screen. There are some users that have no visual disabilities at all. They may have a reading or cognitive disability where hearing that content audibly allows it to be better understood or perceived than reading it visually on the page. Slide 46 is structure and semantics. When we talk about screen reader accessibility, we want to ensure that we're defining structure, that we're defining meaning or semantics into our page to enhance accessibility, to better present the content that's apparent visually to sighted users. So things like providing alternative text for images, you want to present the content and function of an image in alternative text. For a screen reader user that can't see the image, that alternative text would be read in place of or as an alternative to that image. So content and function, those are the two keywords. I think this is the shortest treatment I've ever given to alternative text in a presentation. There's so much more to alternative text. I would refer you to an article on the WebAIM site that goes into much more detail and nuance when it comes to alternative text, which in many ways is one of the most complex aspects of accessibility, not because it's difficult to implement, but because it's so subjective. And we walked through several examples in our article to give you a better understanding of how to generate and provide proper and equivalent alternative text. Using headings appropriately, so big and bold text that we use visually to identify the structure of a document. Defining those headings appropriately in the code of your page, a first level heading for the main content heading of the page, second level headings or H2 elements in HTML for subheadings, and third level headings below those. Those facilitate screen reader understanding of the content and also navigation within the page. Screen reader users very often, in fact, it's one of the most common mechanisms for navigation in a page, is to navigate by the headings within a page. So very important for accessibility. You can also define page regions, or sometimes called landmarks, the header area of the page, the footer, the main content area, the navigation areas. Things like that can all be defined semantically in the code of our page, and those can be identified and navigated by a screen reader user. Visually, we come to a new page and we parse out, okay, here's the header, here's the footer, there's the good stuff, the main content, okay, navigation, maybe there's search over here. We visually parse this page, and then we build that mental model of the structure of that page, and every subsequent page that we come to, we don't reread the navigation or the header or the search. You know, we jump right to the good stuff, and if we're looking for navigation, we know where it is because we've built that model. You can provide that same functionality to someone that can't see the page just with a little bit of code defined within your web page. Other things important for screen reader accessibility, associating label text to form input. So if you see the words first name and a text box next to it, we make a visual association. Someone that's blind can't make a visual association between that text and the input, but we can add just a little code under the hood, and almost all of these things I'm talking about are under the hood of our page. They're in the code. They're transparent to the visual design, transparent to the visual interaction, but absolutely vital for non-visual accessibility. So we can provide code that associates that text to the form input. Same thing with a data table. We can scan up or down, left or right in a data table to know what a particular piece of data is because of the visual association with its column headers and maybe row headers. A little bit of a code can provide those same structural and semantic associations for a screen reader user. We should provide a descriptive page title. That's the text that shows up at the in the tab at the top of the page. It's the first thing read by a screen reader. Really useful so the screen reader user knows what the page is about. We can define the document language, you know, if it's English or Spanish or Japanese. For multilingual screen reader users, it ensures that that page is read in the proper language. It's a, like 9 or 10 characters in our HTML code. But under the scenes of our page, totally transparent, but really important for optimal accessibility. Slide 48, just a few things on that topic of operable or operability. I want to ensure that functionality is available via the keyboard. If I can't use a mouse or touchpad, I want to be able to get to everything on the page, perform all of the functionality that's available to mouse users simply using the keyboard. And that it's efficient, you know, that I don't have to hit the tab key 600 times with a stick in my mouth because I don't have other mechanisms to interact in the page. You also want to ensure that keyboard users can tell where they're at within the page. As you hit the tab key, there needs to be a visual indicator, and the browser does this by default. We just need to make sure we don't turn it off and break it as the user is interacting within the page. Okay, slide 49, a couple other things with operable, making sure we provide meaningful link text, so avoiding things like click here, more, continue, things that by themselves may not make a lot of sense. Now, visually, we can usually see those links, and then we can scan before or after that link to figure out what that link is about. There's visual overhead to that, but it's much more difficult for someone that can't visually scan the page. If they're, say, using a screen reader, it can be difficult. As they navigate through the page or read the links in the page, they might hear click here, click here, click here, and that's not very helpful. We can modify that link text to be more descriptive of its function and purpose. We can also facilitate keyboard accessibility by providing a skip link or a skip to main content link within the page, usually one of the first links in the page that allows quick access to bypass the header and navigation and search and sidebar or whatever and get right to the good stuff within the page. Okay, slide 50 deals with understandability. Again, you may notice I'm going through those POUR principles of the guidelines. Consider reading level, legibility, using good design. These are things that can be hard to measure, simplifying, being consistent. These are not defined well in the accessibility guidelines, but they're common sense, which sometimes isn't all that common on the web, but they're really, really important for people to be able to use your content. If they can't understand it, it's not going to do them a lot of good. Being careful with animation, automatically advancing carousels, or like those animating frames on very often on home pages, which automatically advance, autoplaying video. Those can be hugely impactful for a lot of people, especially those with certain types of cognitive and learning disabilities, where they can be significantly distracted by animating content. They can also impact keyboard accessibility, screen reader accessibility within a page. You know, do usability testing with users with disabilities. Take a step back and, you know, as you're doing your testing, include users with disabilities as part of that process can help you identify very often these aspects of understandability that can be impactful. Okay, slide 51, just a little side note here. This is a photo of a courthouse down in Florida. If you can see this image, you may notice something interesting about the accessibility of this entrance. On the left-hand side of this image is a ramp, and the ramp deposits the user in the landing in the middle of the stairs. So on slide 52, there's a little slightly different view of this ramp. It's a very, very long ramp that goes to the landing right in the middle of the stairs. So you might think of this and say, you know, did somebody consider accessibility when they built this entrance? And I would say, yes, they did. They built a ramp, a very long, expensive ramp, but did they really consider accessibility, do they really consider the end user experience? No, maybe they had a checklist that said wheelchair ramp, and you know, check, yep, I mean, we built a ramp, but they didn't consider the entire user process. Imagine if you were a wheelchair user and you come up this ramp to suddenly find that you can't actually get into the building. You know, is this ramp worse than no ramp at all? Sometimes accessibility implemented partway or incorrectly can be worse than no accessibility effort at all. So we want to make sure that we're doing this correctly, and most of all that we're thinking about the user processes or flows, you know, from beginning to end. You know, can the user complete an entire process? And those are things that can be detected via user testing as opposed to accessibility testing. Accessibility testing very often looks at instances of inaccessibility. Very often is checklist driven. Do we have a wheelchair ramp? Yes. Process or task-based user testing is, can the user in a wheelchair get into the building? And the results of that can be very different from just accessibility testing. So you want to think about that. Sometimes those, you know, those processes or flows, that last step, that last page probably won't show very high in your, you know, site analytics. It probably isn't a highly visited website, but very important to the success of the entire process or flow. Okay, slide 53 shows photos of two other entrances to buildings. On the left is a wheelchair ramp. There's a wheelchair sign or placard next to this. On the right is a ground level revolving door. There is accessibility built into this revolving door. There are a couple of things. One, there are sensors within the door. So if you are moving very slowly through this revolving door, it's not going to force you through at its pace. It'll actually slow down and move with you. Say you were using a walker or crutches, had a small child. It'll slow down and move with you. In this case, there is a button on the right-hand side of this entrance. If you activate that button, the door will stop, and visually, the right-hand side of this revolving door is actually folded open. So if you were in a wheelchair, you could go directly in and through that entrance into the building with this revolving door in this state. So both of these entrances provide accessibility. I would argue that the one on the right probably provides better accessibility, at least a better approach to accessibility. Now, we know the wheelchair ramp does provide accessibility, and there are additional benefits to it. You know, I can push my kids in the stroller up there. The delivery person can use that ramp. But kind of what it suggests is, if you have a disability, this is your way of getting into the building, right? You go over here. And in this case, the ramp, you can visually tell the ramp was added after the fact. The color doesn't match the rest of the building. It juts out into the sidewalk. It's maybe even more steep than it should be. This is something that has been added on to provide accessibility after the fact, as opposed to the entrance on the right that has been designed for accessibility from the get-go. It has been, you know, accessibility has been considered and integrated directly into this entrance. Now, yes, there's an additional cost to the accessibility of a ground-level revolving door, but the vast, vast majority of that cost is the decision to put in a revolving door. It's not the accessibility. But by considering accessibility, you now have one entrance that anybody can use the same way, as opposed to the wheelchair ramp, which is, you know, you go over here. Sometimes, say, a restaurant may have a wheelchair ramp, but it's around back, and it, you know, the user has to go through the kitchen to get to eat. Is that an equitable experience? No, it's not. Now, sometimes that retrofitting is a reality. Sometimes you have things that are not inherently accessible, and you have to bolt on that accessibility. It's always going to be difficult. It's always going to be expensive, and it's never going to be as efficient as considering accessibility from the beginning, through early design, through development. And the reality is, as we consider that type of accessibility and build it in, we end up with better things, better for everyone, because the accessibility is inherited naturally into that environment. That's where we need to get with the web. You know, when the ADA first passed, we had our ADA architects that were, you know, an architect would design a building, then your ADA architect would come in and say, oh, this isn't going to work. You have to put in a ramp here, and all these doors have to be wider. and we ended up with these ugly retrofits for accessibility. If you learn to become an architect today, you learn how to design an accessible building. Because it's your job, it's part of what is required of you is to build in this natural accessibility. And so we see fewer ramps, we see more ground level, naturally accessible to everyone entrances. And we need to get there on the web. We need the architects of the web today to understand that accessibility is their job. It is part of what they need to do and implement as opposed to something that is addressed after something has been developed. In which case, yeah, we can maybe make it compliant, but it's not going to be nearly as truly accessible of an experience. Okay, so a little bit of a soapbox there, just about the concept of accessibility and optimal approaches to this. Okay, slide 54. I mentioned earlier the WAVE tool. And this is maybe something that would be useful to you in your accessibility efforts. It's found at wave.webaim.org. It's an online free tool. We have Chrome and Firefox extensions to allow you to do evaluation directly within your browser. If you want to get a good sense of detectable issues, you know, where you're at when it comes to accessibility, this can be helpful. Again, keep in mind tools are quite limited. They can't tell you if your site is accessible or compliant, but they can identify apparent things. And because we know that human testing, human evaluation is a vital part of accessibility, WAVE has been designed to help facilitate that human accessibility testing. We help reveal underlying things that can support your own testing within the page. Okay, slide 55. I want to end with this quote. It reads, "For people without disabilities, technology makes things convenient, whereas for people with disabilities, it makes things possible." So just keep in mind the great power of the web, the great impact of the web that it has on people with disabilities, and go out and make things accessible, which is it's more than just convenience for many people with disabilities. It is their reality. It makes things possible for them. And with that, I will say thank you, and we'll go to any questions that you might have.
Excellent. Thank you, Jared, for all of the great information, lots of information there. For those of you participating in the through the webinar room, you can continue to submit your questions in the chat area. And while you once you submit the question, you do not see it. It is viewable by us on this end. And Natalie, at this time, I'd like you to give instructions again for those on the telephone if they wish to ask a question.
Certainly. To ask a question over the phone, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad.
All right, great. And while we wait to see what questions we get there, Jared, I guess this is my question. From a big picture perspective, you know, what do you see from your experience in working in this arena as the biggest barriers? And I'm not talking about, you know, the actual barriers on a website, but I'm talking about the bigger picture. Is it lack of awareness? Is it lack of experts in the arena? Is it the lack of educating, you know, people in school who are, in computer science programs? What are the biggest, you know, barriers from that larger picture perspective?
Boy, yeah, that's a great question. It's a big question. I could spend another hour and a half probably talking about that. All of the things that you listed, I think, are barriers. They're challenges. And, you know, if you had asked me this question 3 weeks ago, I probably would have said awareness. And that's really what I've generally always said about this, is that awareness is the big thing. And certainly, I think it's a big consideration. There's a lot more we need to do with awareness. But I think awareness is increasing. There are a lot more people that are interested in this topic. We would not have seen, 180 people on this webinar a few years ago. No way. So there is a lot more awareness. I think as that awareness has increased, though, we have not yet seen substantive change. There are pockets of accessibility. There are certainly things that are happening. But our evaluation of a million websites found significant and pervasive accessibility issues all over the web. 98% of pages had detectable compliance failures, and an average of 60 compliance errors or end-user issues per homepage. Imagine being someone with a disability and on average encountering 60 barriers on a homepage. That's the reality of the web today, and that's a little discouraging. So I think my answer today would be lack of support. That I think more developers, designers are aware of this, but it's not being emphasized by leadership. They're not given the resources necessary to actually implement accessibility. The priorities are fancy design, newer technology, innovation, and accessibility very often is not one of those priorities, and it's reflecting in the common, in the web every single day for people with disabilities. So I think my answer to that is shifting a little bit from awareness, and we need to do more awareness, but that awareness doesn't do a lot of good if people are not empowered to implement that accessibility.
Right. Great answer. And so, you know, you went through your presentation. You know, if you were starting at a just hired by a state or local government or a business, and it was your job to address the content of their website, you know, what would be your roadmap? What are the starting points for businesses or for government agencies to get the process rolling to ensure their content's accessible?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Another big question. That's a good one. There's, as you can see from this, there's a lot to accessibility. If you approach it simply as a technical thing, there can be a lot. It can be a little overwhelming, all of the technical things that need to be implemented for accessibility. And I wouldn't start there. I mean, those are important. We need to implement the technical accessibility. But, you know, starting out at a new place, especially if there was not already a strong emphasis on accessibility, I would try to make it real, make it personal, you know, demonstrate the page in a screen reader, even better, allow a user with a disability to talk about their experience, to demonstrate it for themselves, to make that really personal, so that, you know, as an organization, they have a better understanding of the impact that this has, not on people, but on this person and people like him or her. And I think that's where we get a lot better motivation, when it becomes really real. And then transition that into education. People ask us about the cost of accessibility all the time. You know, how much more is it going to cost to make it accessible? And the cost of accessibility really is a function of education and knowledge. You know, if your architect designs that inaccessible building and says, you know, how much is it going to cost to make it accessible, it's going to be a lot. So you're busting down walls and bolting on elevators and wheelchair ramps. You know, again, an architect today, they don't, you know, you wouldn't go to an architect and say, you know, I want to build this building. How much more is it going to cost to make it accessible? We just don't approach physical design that way, because it's their job. It's part of building a building. And, you know, for the web, that additional cost of accessibility is really going to be a function of the knowledge of the practitioners that are designing and building it. And so, you know, transitioning from that awareness and that motivation to, you know, how do we do this? How do we do it effectively is important. We see a lot of people that have some motivation for accessibility but get it wrong, and that can be a little bit difficult, like the wheelchair ramp that goes to the landing in the middle of the stairs, perhaps well-intentioned, but misinformed. So, yeah, you know, moving to that knowledge, as we looked at our analysis of the million pages, the vast majority of the issues that we identified fit into just a few categories. In other words, simply attention to those low contrast, missing alternative text, form, accessibility, identifying the document language. Those few things would address millions and millions of barriers for people with disabilities on the web. So just, you know, those basic foundational principles of accessibility can go a long way.
Great. Natalie, do we have any questions on the phone at this point?
We do. Our first question comes from the line of Kristen Funk. Your line is open.
Oh, yes. Jared, thank you for all your work. I really appreciate your presentation. Hey, I just wondered if we could get a 30,000-foot view opinion on for an agency that needs to be Section 508 and WCAG 2.0 AA guideline compliant. What do you think about WordPress, or do you have specific examples of how small agencies can help to make their website accessible.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yes, thank you, Tristan, for the question. There are, I think there are a lot of good models out there for good accessibility. You mentioned WordPress. WordPress supports, I think, good accessibility. That's actually something we analyzed in our million-page study and found that the presence of WordPress didn't really have a positive or negative impact for overall errors that were detected. So I think WordPress can be a good choice. And there are a lot of others out there. The tool itself is not going to provide the accessibility. It's what you do with that tool in the design and development. I think most of all, I would just go back to the things I talked about a few minutes ago, having as an agency, having that commitment to accessibility. We're finding for some of the agencies out there that really, really have a strong commitment, it is a business differentiator for those. There's a lot of demand for design firms that have good accessibility chops, and they're finding market opportunities there, and then that good training, that good education as a part of that to make sure that as a firm you're actually implementing accessibility correctly and being a good model for accessibility.
Great. Thanks for the question. I'm going to do a follow-up question. Someone that asked something that sort of ties into this, but when you had mentioned verify and what did you say? I took a note here. Trust and verify. So you're looking at, are there resources? Is there, what kind of questions can folks, ask to evaluate? I mean, just like you would with any contractor, you want to make sure that your contractor, if they're putting in a new toilet for you or whatever, you want to make sure that they know what they're doing and they're complying with building code or plumbing code or whatever. So, are there resources, are there questions that can be asked, using a VPAT? Is that a tool an entity that does have compliance obligations that they can ask in evaluating whether or not a vendor is appropriately knowledgeable?
Yeah, this is a distinct pain point when it comes to procurement that many that are evaluating offers in procurement don't have the accessibility expertise to evaluate accessibility. Certainly good documentation would be helpful, a VPAT or other documentation of accessibility is great. I would generally suggest if all that documentation says is passes, there's no indication of inaccessibility, that usually is suspect. Full compliance with the accessibility guidelines can be difficult. It can take a lot of effort to get there, and for many or probably the vast majority of products that are out there, they're not fully compliant. And so you want to look for the areas where there is documentation of non-compliance. Ask questions about the impact of those areas of noncompliance. Ask about their testing methodologies. That can be really insightful. What did you use specifically to do this testing? And if they say Wave or some other automated tool, that's not going to be sufficient. They will had to have done more manual testing, probably using assistive technology, screen reader testing. What is their knowledge and familiarity with the accessibility guidelines? And then kind of extending from that, I would ask them about their accessibility support. What are they going to do if it's not accessible? And I would build that into the procurement. We're seeing a lot more of that language that has teeth. If you sell us something and you've declared it to be accessible or compliant and we find out that it's not, you're going to make it right, and that's something that's built into procurement. We're even starting to see indemnity language and language that says, hey, if we're sued or get a complaint over this, you're going to cover our expenses to defend that and to make it right. So those are some additional things. Ultimately, though, we need procurement mechanisms for better evaluation. There are some efforts afoot to better define testing and for procurement people and sharing of that information and resources. So, every entity out there doesn't have to evaluate the same tool individually, but that information can be shared across, say, organizations, higher ed institutions, things like that. So there's a central body or repository for that accessibility and knowledge.
Great, great. And Natalie, do we have any more questions on the telephone at this time?
We do. Our next question comes from the line of Gary Bellew. Your line is open.
Yeah, I had the question. Once you find your management system and you got it, like, say, WordPress or whatever that might be, is there a special code that we can use to be seen on Google more prominent as an accessibility site?
Oh, yeah, good question. Okay, so the question was, if you choose your platform, say something like WordPress, is there a way to can be more visible because of that accessibility? Not really directly. Now, something like WordPress, if you were to, say, publish or create your own theme, there are ways to mark those themes as accessible, and that can, and, if you, other people searching for a WordPress theme, you naturally search for accessible themes. Now, as before, trust but verify. You want to test that for yourself. But no, most of that, those benefits that come from, say, search engines happen organically because of that accessibility, making it more machine readable, in providing alternative text, labels, good heading structures, identifying regions for your page. Those are all things that support better search engine friendliness. I'm not going to say search engine optimization, but our clients have really found those benefits come organically by providing good content. And also, a lot of what Google is looking for is they consider traffic and relevance of that content. And if your content is good, if it's accessible, you're going to naturally get that content. You're going to get cross links. Those are all things that benefit accessibility. There is some evidence that implementation of accessibility techniques can automatically provide some sort of search engine boost. Google seems to have some metric that says, wow, there are techniques implemented into this site that are supportive of accessibility. Therefore, somebody must care. They've implemented some, and they've done effort for accessibility. Therefore, we're going to provide them some additional search engine benefit and ranking because of that. That's not something that you define. It's not like you add a tag that says, hey, Google, we're accessible. But the implementation of those good structure, semantics, and good content, and everything else I've talked about will bring those benefits.
All right, great. Thank you for that question. The use of social media, where businesses or state or local governments embed their social media, for instance, a Twitter feed in their homepage or website. What are potential accessibility issues when you're bringing in a third party into your website?
Yeah. So I would first indicate that simply because it's third party embedded within your site does not get you off the hook, right? The courts have clearly, stated that, embedding something like a Twitter feed, that's still part of your page, that's part of your content, and thus you could be held liable for the accessibility of it. So it's not just a, get out of jail free card there because it's third party. Those things can pose issues. We need better accessibility for those types of components and widgets, and we need to put pressure back on those third-party providers to support better accessibility. As far as, if you have these things today and what you can do, you can implement mechanisms for users to bypass those. Very often, native clients and readers might be more accessible than the embedded versions. For instance, an embedded YouTube video, allowing the user to go directly out to YouTube to view it, is very often a more accessible experience. Viewing it, say, your Twitter feed on the Twitter website or within their end user client very often is more accessible than an embedded feed. So I'm not saying you can't do those things. You want to consider test accessibility, but very often you provide a link, a mechanism to get back to the, to view that in another way can be a good strategy.
Great, great. Thank you very much for all of that information. Unfortunately, we are near the bottom of the hour, and we are quickly running out of time here. So if you submitted a question or still had a question, we'd encourage you to reach out to Jared and the folks at WebAIM, as well as reaching out to your regional ADA center for additional information. All of Jared's speaker bio is available on ada-audio.org, so you can read his full bio on that page. So I want to thank Jared for joining us today, not just for the 90-plus minutes he gave us today, but for his time in prepping and doing a test session with us to get this this session off. So I want to remind you that our next session will be April the 16th. We will have a session titled Ask the EEOC. For those of you that have been with us for any period of time, you'll recognize the name Sharon Runnert. She's an attorney with EEOC within their ADA division. You can submit questions in advance for that session. You can get registration information, again, by visiting ada-audio.org. Today's session has been recorded, is being recorded, and the archive will be available, the audio archive will be available within 24 hours, and we'll get a written transcript posted and edited within a couple weeks' time. You can check back again to ada-audio.org. If you have questions about the ADA audio conference series, give us a call at 877-232-1990. I want to thank everyone for joining us today. Thanks again to Jared. Take care, everyone, and good day.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect. Have a great day.